Accession number 16750, Reel 2.
That's right. Well, I got this, and this wasn't easy to do in those days, so I then realised that I had to get down to it. I had already realised that, but having got it, one did do a lot of flying instruction. I mean, you very rarely did more than 35 to 40 minutes in a sortie, and you were often getting 80 and 90 hours a month. In the Master, which was quite the most uncomfortable aeroplane, one of the most dangerous aeroplanes at the Aldown stall, and quite one of the best trainers, purely and simply because if you could fly a Master properly, you didn't find any difficulty whatever with a Hurricane, a Typhoon, or a Spitfire for that matter. So that was good.
What did it do at an Aldown stall? Just spin or what?
No, it dropped a wing so violently that you had more or less to pick it up before it dropped, you know, the kind of thing. And if, bearing in mind, you know, there you are, little grass airfield at Peterborough, over the goods yards, in you come on this particular business, sitting in the back, immensely cold.
Because you had your head sticking out the top.
You had your head and your upper body sticking out of the top with a tilting windscreen. Dear, oh dear. Not really being able to see what was going on too clearly. And he would bounce it, and then you'd have to be able to tell him what was going to happen if he didn't put the power on, and then put it on when he almost invariably failed, initially anyway, to get it on in time. Very tricky, but very good. Well, once you'd learn that, that kind of landing in any kind of aeroplane never bothered me much at all afterwards. And there we were. So it was a thoroughly good advanced trainer. But and its performance, of course, it was much faster than most of the OTU Hurricanes. So you had an 870 horsepower Mercury, and the damn thing only weighed about 4,000 pounds. It was made of wood, and it would really go. So there we were. Anyway, after that, having more or less enjoyed the later bit, I went on to AFU instructing, or really pre-OTU instructing, at the AFU at Wrexham, which was designed to give people Hurricane experience before they went on to Typhoons. And I was there from the end of 44 to mid 45, and in mid 45, happily, I went to the Central Gunnery School, and one of the main threads of my flying career started, because at the Central Gunnery School I became a pilot attack instructor, and pilot attack instructing all forms of attack weapons work were one of the main threads of my service life thereafter, test flying, of course, later on being the other one.
So you were on Hurricanes at Wrexham, and then when you were going on your fighter attack instructing?
Well, the Central Gunnery School was equipped with Spitfires.
Yeah.
Yes, I did I had in the middle of 1940 actually done a quick Spitfire flying experience on Mark 1s and 2s, believe it or not, at Cranwell on the grass airfield there, because they had this squadron there and they were prepared to take instructors who wanted to go there and do it. You tended not to get leave if you did that kind of thing, but it didn't matter. I went there, and in fact the second Mark 1 I flew was actually so old it had a pump undercarriage, which is a very rare thing, even in those days in a Spitfire. And I did 10 hours or so on Spitfires there, and that was that. And once done, never forgotten, and all the rest of the marks of Spitfires one flew stemmed from there on. Of course, at Central Gunnery School, the flying was applied flying of a pretty advanced nature, but again, the Spitfire, although not as kind of old shoe comfy as a Hurricane, was when you knew how to fly it and had got the gen on the kind of strange, not being able to see where you're going type of curved approach landing and all the rest of that stuff was really very good and very easy, and you felt very, very comfortable in them. So there was the course. And
where was the school?
The school was at Catfoss in those days.
Catfoss,
yes, in East Yorkshire.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, having done it and qualified well, they wanted me to go back as the chief ground instructor, because it was held that one could lecture a bit, and I didn't want to do that, so I turned it down. Went back to gunnery instruction on the French SFTS, and then on number 17 SFTS at Harlaxton at Grantham, very briefly, and then 5 months later they asked me to go back, or they posted me back there as a flying gunnery instructor, a pilot attack instructor on the fighter combat squadron, which was then a Spitfire 16 squadron.
Oh, the war ended by this time?
Yes, the war had. The war ended, the war in Europe ended while I was actually on the CGS course.
Mm.
And when I went to, well, the war in the Far East, of course, hadn't ended,
mm-hmm.
and we had thought that we were going to be off for that, as you can imagine, but we were not, happily, and I shouldn't have liked that very much either, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
But one went on, and of course, as I said, after this little extra bit of SFTS instructing with the Frogs and at one of our own SFTSs on gunnery, which was not really very exciting, on Harvard's, incidentally. I was trained on Harvard's anyway. But there we were. I went back into CGS as an instructor, and after a brief time, I became the flight commander of that particular flight. And in another year, I got an acting squadron leader rank, and I stayed there in that post from the end of... Well, I stayed at CGS from the end of 45 to mid-48. And of course, at the end, I had a flight, as it was called, it's the combat flight. There was 12 Spitfire 16s, 5 Master 2s for dual training, and 3 Meteor 3s. So, by modern standards, it was a very sizable flight indeed. And there we were. And
there was a point reached, though, when the war ended, when you had to make a decision about staying in the RAF or going back to Civvy Street.
Oh, yes, that's true.
What forces came into play?
Oh,
then?
The forces came into play then were just sheerly basic, sensible ones. Wanted to continue flying, because I definitely got a fair old urge for it then. B, couldn't imagine, with the fact that, well, just from the Air Force alone, of course, 1.1 million personnel down in 2 years to 350,000, all those people in the jobs market, didn't even think of it in those days, frankly, in that way, but nevertheless, didn't want to leave, did want to stay. Said, may I please do so? Ah, they said, well, I don't know, we'll have to wait and see about that.
Were you married at that time?
Yes, I was. Mm. I was married for the first time. Mm. My first wife died later on in this particular thing, but that was before Mary and I were married, of course, and that was not a good thing.
The reason I raised it was, you know, do you have family considerations? You wanted continuity of employment?
I did, because we had one child. We had a daughter who lives in Canada now and has children. I have my grandchildren stretch from the 14, 15-month-old one who's with us at the moment to 27 years old. Because that's what happens if you... I don't know. I suppose in retrospect, I'm rather ashamed that it didn't occur to me. What did occur to me was, I can do this. It's not easy to do. And I want to continue doing it. I enjoy it. And I'm sure that I can convince them that I should do it. Well, the follow-on to your question was the fact that I managed to get an extended service commission, which was seven years, and I got that, I suppose, in mid-48. And while I was still at Central Gunnery School, I got that in mid-48. And then later on, the next stage of the story, I got a permanent commission, which of course I held until I left. And I left Central Gunnery School. I dropped my acting rank, which was A, inevitable, and B, one knew one was going to, and C, in the Air Force of that particular time, I was extraordinarily lucky to get it, and held it, and it worked well, and I got an Air Force Cross when I finished the bit in Central Gunnery School, because it was fairly arduous stuff, and some of it was faintly advanced, let's put it that way. Anyway, I did, and that was that. Dropped the rank, knew I was going to. It's surprising how painful it is, though, because as a squadron leader, you're sir to everybody else, and when you're back to a flight lieutenant again, squadron leaders are sir to you. It didn't take me long to get over it, but it is a hiccup. It's got to be admitted, it's a hiccup. But at that time, I was posted from there to the Middle East, to Nicosia in Cyprus, to start and then to run as chief instructor the Middle East Armament Practice School, which I did with enormous enjoyment from mid-48 to the end of 50. And that was a time when there were 8 fighter squadrons in the Middle East Air Force of different types. Initially Spitfire 18, Tempest 6, Brigand, and then subsequently Vampire, Mosquito 36 with a night fighter squadron, and I think that's just about all. And we used the squadron, effectively speaking, we used it as an instructional tool for air-to-air firing, air-to-ground firing, and dive bombing. In each particular case, the Mosquito 36s did night firing, and all this was from my point of view, because there were only 2 instructors, myself and another chap, both PAIs, of course, and it was an instructional thing. We took them, we did their films, we flew with them in the aircraft that had 2 spaces, or alternatively flew alongside them in another aircraft of their own squadron. And it was, in short, a lovely time, because it was in Cyprus, which was pleasant. North Cyprus, of course, Nicosia, not Sin City South as it is nowadays. But nevertheless, there we were, and one was one's own boss, virtually. There was the wing commander flying, who was an experienced and distinguished ex-wartime fighter pilot, and it was from him to me, and then from me, more or less parallel to the squadron leader, squadron commanders of the squadron, some of whom were national famous names and really splendid chaps like Dennis Crowley Milling of 6th Squadron, that kind of thing. It was a lovely time, I enjoyed it greatly, and there we were. And towards the end of it, I applied to go on the Empire Test Pilot School, and in those days, if they thought you would probably doing better where you were than where you wanted to go, then you didn't go. Happily, just before I left, they changed the Air Ministry order, and if you applied to go to the Empire Test Pilot School, you had to be sent to be interviewed. And I did apply again, and I wasn't actually sent to be interviewed, because the commandant, Arthur Clouston, a well-known record-breaking and chap and general all-round brave chap to boot, was visiting Cyprus. And I came screaming back from the range in a Spitfire 18 and tore into the circuit and went down there all covered with sweat, as one always was in those days. And he interviewed me there and then on the tarmac, and he told the Air Commodore commanding Cyprus that that was all right. He'd take me, no argument. I didn't need to come back to England for a test which was extremely serious on the mathematical side, and which I might well have failed on that basis. So there we were. And that started the Empire Test Pilot School in 1951. And I went there in 1951. I'm sure you know about the Empire Test Pilot School, but the great thing is that it was, you know, the first of the test flying schools, called the Empire desirably, and still called the Empire. And in those days, it trained quite a lot of both the United States Air Force and the United States Navy test pilots. They were just building up their own test pilot schools. They had them, but ours was more or less considered to be certainly the cream of the crop. And that was so. I think during the early 50s anyway, after which, of course, Edwards and Patuxent, with the enormous thrust and all the funding and general American effort and get up behind them, they steamed ahead and, of course, are still ahead now.
The interesting thing, I think it was Winkle Brown who was explaining this to me, that the Germans built a lot of very interesting prototypes during the war.
Yeah.
But they hadn't got a systematised method of test flying.
No.
They hadn't defined test flying. They hadn't put it into a syllabus for
no.
Which is what the ETPS presumably was set up to do.
Yes, it was. And of course, it I can't remember exactly, to my shame, when it started in the war, but certainly it was there in 41, 42.
As early as that?
Oh, yes. Again, shameful. It's old age, I'm afraid. The memory bit. Where it was before it moved to Farnborough. Mm. It
wasn't it Bristol, was it?
No, it wasn't, Rodney. It's quite ridiculous that I should forget that.
I've got a picture of the first course, actually.
Yes.
I must go back and look it up. And it does say where it was taken.
Yes, it was. They were. It'll come to me before the end of the. At least I hope it'll come to me before the end
anyway,
of our discussion.
I mean, your time on the course presumably was very fulfilling and stretching, was it? Or?
Yes, it was. Mm. It was indeed. And Winkle, whom I know well, is quite right. That was good because we had it and we had it right, and there wasn't any. A fudging or anything of that sort. You went, you got your tests and your trials. I didn't quite, but it was roughly the same sort of thing. And unless you did and passed them, you didn't get in. And unless you passed through there regularly with all the checks, etc., etc., and could cut the mustard, you didn't go on. I must say the selection processes were so good and so rigorous that very few people failed the Empire Test Pilot School. And nobody did on my course. But in those days, you occasionally got people killed on it. One on our course was killed in a Sea Fury when the master Conrod broke. Well, you know, you can imagine a two-row radial engine of 2,500 horsepower very nearly. Master Conrod breaks, you haven't got anything. He was a Scotsman and a very good aviator indeed, but just a little bit too Scottish, bless him. He was a close friend of mine. Decided... Yes, he could get onto the short runway at Farnborough, but he wasn't sure he'd be able to stop. So he'd go round onto the interwind runway, the long runway, the east-west runway. And, of course, the Sea Fury's got a phenomenally high rate of sink with no engine and so on and so forth. And he just undercooked it, and he pranged just on the other side of the Farnborough Road, killing himself instantly, but not killing anybody else, happily. Mm. But there we were. It went on, and it was very interesting. It was demanding, but the great thing is when you'd finished it, you knew that you could go to the squadron you were selected to go to, knowing what your business was, not perhaps on a better-than-learning attitude, not perhaps on a journeyman attitude, but approaching that, because there was still, obviously, a certain amount of on-the-job training when you got to a place like A Squadron, at Boscombe, which is where I went afterwards in early 52.
We've got you then to A Squadron now. Can you define for me fairly briefly the functions of an RAF test pilot as opposed to a manufacturer's test pilot?
Yes, you can. I can, at least I think I can. Firstly, the aeroplanes that go there have already been tested to certain limits by the firm's test pilot, and the firm's technical office have passed the technical information across to the Boscombe Down tech office for the squadron concerned. So you know what the score is, and you know what the limits of the testing you're supposed to do on that aeroplane, what the limits are, and your purpose then is to go through a complete, if it's a comprehensive handling test, to go through the complete gamut of handling on that aeroplane, from ground handling right the way through all the flying conditions of airspeed, Mach number, stalling, spinning, approach, and various other landing, obviously, and various other things of that sort, go through that, assessing that aeroplane as you would like to see it, as a service aircraft, as a fighter particularly. Is it as it should be, in accordance with the fact that when you do these things, is the right answer there? And ultimately, is it the kind of thing that a squadron pilot is going to be able to cope with when he first comes up with it? And that's the basis. It wasn't always, of course, used in quite that way. And occasionally, aeroplanes that perhaps ought to have been looked at Boscombe weren't. And occasionally, aeroplanes were sent to Boscombe without either the test pilot's personal views, which aren't necessarily the tech office's views, I hasten to add, but whether the combined firm's views aren't passed over to Boscombe at the time. And when that happens, you can have some nasties. And I did have, of course, I did a four-year tour at Boscombe, and I did have, quite apart from the Swift, two extreme nasties under those circumstances.
What were those?
Well, those were, first of all, well, the worst one was the Venom 2, which was sent to the place originally. The Venom had three different empennage designs during the time it was tested at Boscombe. It came to us first in A Squadron. This was the night fighter variant. Very fat, of course, very swollen at the front. Yes, obviously going to be directionally a little bit twitchy. And it was, and we did, after, you know, just the general bit of making sure that you knew how the stalling, spinning and everything of that sort, or the stalling anyway, was going to go on, you did lateral and directional trials. Well, in straight side slips, it was quite clear that the rudder was overbalancing, and that the side slips were, in actual fact, becoming unstable and developing. You didn't have enough rudder to cope with it. I used the term overbalance there when I shouldn't have done. It was just that in straight side slips, it was becoming unstable. So we sent it back to the firm, which was the thing you did. You didn't say, well, I mean, what are we going to do about this? You just said, here it is, and we think it's wrong in this respect, and here is a great report from the tech office, contributed to by the squadron pilot, and this is what we think about it. Please put it right. And then they would do so. They'd trial it again, and then they'd send it back to you. Well, the second stage, or this the stage we're talking about now, was when that had already happened with the NF2, and they had given it straight side slip tests. There'd been no question of rudder misbehaviour or of the side slip getting out of control, and that was it, and they sent it back to us. We did straight side slip trials on it and found that it was just a little bit tender. But nevertheless, we decided, because the firm had done spinning, or assured us they'd done spinning, and we would go on with the spinning trials. Well, that was my aeroplane, so I did virtually all of these basic things, and we did the spinning trial. It was epoch-making, it really was. They used to use the voice recorder on the thing at Empire Test Pilot School just to show you how wrong something could go. Because as it started the spin, 42,000 feet, I think, it spun for two turns, and then it was a fighter, of course, so it only had to spin for two turns. So after two turns, I put recovery action in, and the rudder locked on, and the aircraft side-slipped violently, and I couldn't get the rudder off. And I pushed extremely violently, and the aircraft, all the time, was rotating extremely quickly, and down we were going at a fair old rate. Got the rudder unlocked. It went straight through. I couldn't stop it in its central position. Locked on the other side. Aircraft changed spin. Nose right down past the vertical. Height by this time down into the high 20s. Mach number above the limit which the aircraft was cleared to. And everything in a bit of a state. Finally got it centred. Stopped it spinning and gently eased out of the ensuing dive and finished straight and level and panting heavily at 17,000 feet. Now, I am as convinced as I am that you're sitting there that aeroplane hadn't been properly tested at the firm. And that's all there is to it. So we sent it back again with some fairly terse words. And it was a long time before it got it back. And when we got it back, it had a completely redesigned rear end. Because the basic trouble with the thing was it just did not have enough dorsal fin area, either with the dorsal strake, which was already on it, or with the vertical stabilisers itself, twin fin, of course, in order to give sufficient stability. And that was that. So that was just that was a classic case of what I'm quite sure was naughtiness. But I mean, it's an imperfect world, isn't it?
Well, that's what you're there for, presumably, anyway.
Precisely.
You didn't want a Sprog squadron pilot getting into those difficulties.
God, no. And in addition to that, of course, after all, when, for instance, you bought your beautiful motor car on the basis that you knew it would be absolutely okay, but people don't take people's word for things quite automatically, do they? I mean, it's either got a reputation and umpteen people have contributed to it, or it's the kind of thing where you say, well, I hear what you say, but I'm going to try it for myself. That's what the test squadrons at Boscombe were all about.
What was the other nasty you had?
Well, the other nasty wasn't actually to do with the firm, because the firm was Armstrong Whitworth, I beg your pardon, who were a very good firm indeed. This is the Meteor 12. And funnily enough, it was a very, very similar kind of thing. It was, in actual fact, fin stalling, because the Meteor 12, very much like the Meteor 11, you know, the long-nosed twin-engine variant with the radar, fitted a new American radar, which needed an extra 14 inches in front of the normal axis of the aeroplane. Well, obviously, with something of that sort, it had to be tested fairly rigorously in the lateral and directional sense, and it was, and it again was another one of my aeroplanes, and we'd done quite a lot of side slipping on it, and it was a very amiable aeroplane, and Armstrong Whitworth always sent their aeroplanes very well instrumented, and it the long nose Meteors were really very good aeroplanes indeed. I loved them, and this was a particularly good one. And I had a test observer in the back, and we were doing this thing, and there was this side slip, which is a very artificial test. It's just to say, if he does whatever he bloody well can do to get this thing moving sideways, is it going to behave properly? And it did, at again 40,000-odd feet, with full slide slip, full opposite lateral control to the side slip, and foot absolutely fully forward, and the aeroplane side-slipping like fun. I can't remember the speed, but it doesn't matter very much in any event. It was within the proper range. And I was yakking away at the time to the observer, and I thought, well, we're absolutely there, Ingle, and let's just give it an extra push and make sure that we have got it. Well, the Meteor had rubber rudder stops, because otherwise the rudder, when it was banging around, made a fiendish noise and a metal-to-metal clanging, and it just had little rubber stops. They were only about, I suppose, quarter of an inch thick. Anyway, I pressed on this vigorously and enthusiastically, and all of a sudden the fin stalled, and the aeroplane went sideways and behaved from there on like a falling sycamore leaf. And that took a little bit of getting out of as well. Unfortunately, the tech office chap in the back, the flying technician, bless him, they stopped it, incidentally, after this particular accident. They wouldn't let him fly anymore after this particular incident, I should say. And he was one of these imperturbable chaps, and used to say, and I'd said, my God, it's this, that and the other, and some fairly fruity language was coming out while I was struggling to get this thing out. It was fully instrumented. I pushed 960 pounds on one rudder in order to get it unlocked. It just shows you.
960?
Yeah. You're back against the back of the seat and every fibre of your being pushing. And there we were. It was on the record. And that was it. So we got it unlocked in the end, but it did three changes. There, 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 before it stopped. And all the time, when I was saying, "What was that? Did you say, Skipper?" almost out of an Ealing film. And there we were. That was the second one, and really, that wasn't the firm's fault at all.